Thanks for joining us at Cults to Consciousness. This storytelling podcast is meant to be for entertainment purposes only and does not substitute for any medical advice. We may discuss triggering topics, and we ask that you make your personal mental health a priority. Lastly, the opinions of our guests do not necessarily reflect the opinions of the host.
He admits from A to C what he did. Then we were supposed to find out, was there an evil purpose or destructive intention that prompted you to commit that overt, the admission of a felony? Then the person has a chance to be like, yeah, there was an evil purpose to essay every child. And the person goes, oh yeah, I was very confused because I was sexually attracted, but I didn't know where it was coming from. And I think I knew him from another lifetime. Oh my God, your needle is floating. Oh my God, I now told us, admitted that you did that, all to lead to I was confused. And then the technology worked.
What, Serge? My mind is blown right now. That is incredibly dangerous. And you are a child. There's just so many things wrong with this.
5 hours a day. For five hours, Shaliza. They were calling it redemption time.
Hey, my name is Shalice Ansola, and this is Cults to Consciousness, where we discuss leaving high-demand religions or organizations and finding healing and independence through awareness and true individual sovereignty. As always, if you're only listening and you would like to see our faces, you can go to our YouTube channel at Cults to Consciousness, where you can join in on the conversation. Leave those encouraging words for our guests who are coming on and telling their stories. This channel would not exist without them, so we want to give our love and support. And of course, liking and sharing and becoming a subscriber is also extremely helpful for the algorithm. So today's guest, we were connected with him a little bit ago, and we were like, okay, now's the time to bring you on and tell your story. We're going into more Scientology stories today. And he was actually born and raised in Scientology, ended up signing the billionaire contract when he was young, and ended up having to do lots of auditing sessions as a child. We're here to talk about his perspective as a child in Scientology, what that means psychologically, how he was able to get out, and how he is now protesting and doing all of these videos on his own channel. So thank you so much for joining us, Serge Del Mar.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Of course. I'm really glad that you reached out to us. We've been, like I said, we're waiting. I'm like, okay, when are we going to bring him in? It's like the double Dutch game, right? Trying to figure out these interviews. So we appreciate your patience with us. And you've done lots of collaborations with other Scientology channels as well. So this isn't your first time telling your story. And you were actually on the Aftermath show with Leah Remini.
Yes, I was in the very last episode.
So I'm happy to have you here. And I guess before we dive into too much of the Scientology, I would love it if you would talk about how you changed your last name and the meaning behind that.
Definitely. I think a lot of us that go through this cult experience as children battle with the identity that was given to us. And at one point I felt, especially through the disconnection of my parents and my having to reconcile the facts, I didn't feel like Gil was a last name that ever really actually belonged to me. And I felt, you know, I was brought into the Sea Org, and I am from Mexico, so I really love the sound of Del Mar, which means of the sea. And I felt like I was never of the Sea Org, but I was always of the sea.
Yeah, that's a beautiful reclamation of your name. I did the same thing. I changed my last name as a power move, something that resonated with me because of my own childhood traumas. And so I can 100% relate to you in taking ownership of something that's so uniquely you. And it feels so much better to say a name that you really resonate with. So I applaud it. Well done. I support it.
Thank you.
So let's get into your childhood then. And we'll kind of go, I mean, along the way, we'll probably have to explain certain Scientology terminology. So bear with me there. I know normally you speak to other Scientology channels, and so you don't always have to explain all the nitty gritty. But for people who are just now joining our channel and may not be completely familiar with Scientology, we'll just kind of sprinkle that in as we go. So you were born in Mexico, you said, and your parents were highly involved in Scientology. So what are your earliest memories of your childhood? And what did that look like?
So yes, my parents, this is like, we're talking late 70s. that they had already signed a billion-year contract. So I was already born inside of their billion-year contract, so to speak.
Right.
My earliest childhoods were memories I have. It's like we were kept in these like really big industrial buildings. They had a castle at the time. It was called Castillo de Chapultepec. So it was like this big castle that they were leasing. But then they got kicked out of it because they weren't able to pay the rent. So back in the 70s, they weren't the wealthy people that they appear to be now, because this is back when they were literally getting investigated by the FBI. So they were like, you know, L. Ron Hubbard was on the run and Scientology was sort of like trying to survive. But it was almost like a little bit like, we don't know what's going to happen, you know, because L. Ron Hubbard was on the run back then. So L. Ron Hubbard was on the run, and these orgs in Mexico were constantly struggling for money. Back in the day, they didn't have as much rich patrons and all of that. So we moved around a lot. And so we were in that castle space, and then we were in this other facility that they had dog training on top of the ceiling, these weird houses that were all concrete. You know, we were like 80 or 90 underage kids. We're talking like babies. And we were being like looked after by this girl that was 16 years old. And yeah, it was just very neglectful. It was just, you know, I mean, again, it's like the idea that our parents were saving our world while they were neglecting their own kids. It's just like, it's the cognitive dissonance is as real as it gets.
Yeah. And let's lay a little bit of that groundwork for people who aren't familiar. So as far as I'm aware, Scientology says that there are no such thing as children. They're billion-year or trillion-year souls in a small body, and so they should be treated like adults. They don't take care of the children at developmentally appropriate ages or developmentally appropriate ways. They just treat you like adults. So you don't get that interaction that you should get as a child. And like you said, they're being watched by people who aren't their parents, because it's very looked down on for people in the Sea Org to have children in the first place. Is that a fair assessment?
Yeah, you know, it's changed and evolved throughout the years, because, you know, back in the days there in Mexico, they were sort of allowing it. Again, it was like at that time, it was like L. Ron was on the run. And then, you know, my parents were working in this institution, and they were saving a world. But all these parents in Scientology, especially in Mexico, they all had children. There were tons of children, you know, like children were always in there. And they're very young children, because at the time, my parents were in their early 20s and everybody was, you know, having children, being still on staff is what they called it. But, you know, they were just very fanatical about the work that they were doing and how they were helping in a way. And it completely made them have no consciousness over what they were doing to their kids as they were neglecting them in real time. That's all I could say. It's like they were very fanatical about doing something and they were not showing up for their own kids.
What were your early memories then growing up of your parents? Do you remember them being around at all? Do you remember having any sort of opinions of them?
Yes. I mean, I remember missing them. I remember, you know, feeling lonely there in these facilities, because it was just hours and hours and hours of no contact with your parents. And yes, there were a lot of children, but it's almost like they were using children to babysit other children. No one was looking after us, and it was just a lot of neglect. So I didn't have a bond per se with my parents, although I felt like I missed them. And I ended up drinking paint thinner in a large quantity. And that ended up me being in the hospital. And that's what finally woke my mom up to be like, oh, hell no, like I need to be a mom. And this happened. And I was saving a world. And then my child almost died. So then, and I had a younger sister too, she's 3 years younger than me. So she was like, even in a crib. I was by this time, I think 5. She couldn't even walk. But then my parents did grab us and take us out and left Scientology because of that accident.
That's pretty amazing that that woke them up, or that shook them enough to realize that this isn't a healthy space for you. I mean, some parents don't get that wake up call, and their children are consistently in danger. So this is something where they realized, okay, we need to actually watch our children. We're going to leave Scientology, which is also a huge deal. Do you know if they had family in Scientology, or was it a big deal for them to leave?
It was, because yes, you know, and especially in Latin America, like, they get a lot of, the whole entire family becomes it. In Latin countries, they really go for like the aunt, the uncle, the cousin, the this, like everybody's, in my family, everybody got implicated, everybody. And the ones that weren't were just, I think, like a couple in both sides, and they were complete black sheep. Nobody wanted to have anything to do with them. And imagine that, you know, like one of my aunts, she was the only one that had the actual college education, you know, and she was the one that was ostracized because she started asking questions and saying, this doesn't seem right. She asked for her money back. And that made her a complete suppressive. And then nobody wanted to talk to her. And, you know, she did end up then offing herself and writing in writing in her note that this was like, you know, she was, like, it's like your whole world turns upside down, like your entire family turns on you, because now all of a sudden this convicted felon, L. Ron Hubbard, has some technology that they're all in on. And it's sort of like, it's so dangerous.
Yeah, it's really scary, the system that they wrote people into. And it starts very innocent, as far as I'm aware. I mean, I've been approached. I live in LA and they're all over the streets, like trying to get actors or wannabe actors. And I was even approached in an extras line. I was trying to sign up for extras agency, and they're just walking down the line, handing out like, do you want to be famous? Join Scientology. And it's things like, learn how to have a better stage presence, or learn how to attract the right roles, or whatever it is that sounds good. But then when you get deeper and deeper into it, it gets more and more controlling, more dangerous. And I think if it weren't for Leah Remini's show that you were on, most people wouldn't know about how dangerous Scientology is, because it seems so, I don't want to say laughable, but from the outside, people are just like, oh, those Scientologists. But they don't really know what's going on behind these closed doors and in the Sea Org. And so I'm so happy for people such as yourself who are coming on and telling their stories and really exposing all the dangerous things, because it also costs a ton of money. So I imagine your aunt was thinking, yeah, I don't want to be a part of this, but I still need this money so I can make a living. Because was it in your case where they really tell you to give all of your money? Did you remember your parents living in any sort of poverty? Are you living in poverty for the church?
I mean, that's part of what the scam is built on, this dependency on this fake structure that is, you know, replacing your family, right? Because your family lineage becomes your alliance to everything that's going down in hotels and commercial buildings. It's so ridiculous when you stripped it down to what the facts are. You know what I mean? It's like, at the end of the day, you really have to understand that for me to think that my grandparents, I'm third generation, so my grandparents moved to this hotel in Florida where they really wore a fake military uniform and told themselves, I'm here to save a world. But my grandmother was a supervisor, meaning that she was graduating the people, meaning that she was a groomer. Because like this, all of this is dysfunctional stuff got groomed by people that were teaching the course. And, you know, everyone has the fact that it's like, it was not your idea, because it was all L. Ron Hubbard's ideas, but you were still being used to groom the ideas using dolls, Shalice. I mean, dolls. Like we would drill all of these things, going back to the acting stuff. We were drilling stuff with dolls, as if we're acting, we're learning scripts, we're being told this is a script drill. This is how you have to sound. This is what you have to say. This is how you have to interrogate others. In what world are things being role-played with that level of precision? There's no interpretation of prose or anything like that. It's just this robotic, methodical way of doing things that are in a book without any critical thinking skills. It's very dangerous when it comes to what the children get exposed to. And that's why I've said over and over, it's like, we cannot control what other people are comfortable with. You want to get all of your finances controlled by these people? That's what they're going to do. They're going to control your finances. They're going to control your children. They're going to control everything about your life. But I mean, again, going back to, well, children are off limits. I'm sorry. Like, that's not something you can just package into this deal to be part of this group, that whatever it is that they said that they are. I don't have in any way, shape, or form an understanding that I was practicing a religion as I was put to be also a groomer. I was made to be a supervisor at age 15. I was a minor. What in the hell was I doing inside a hotel giving people certificates, Shalice? My passport was locked up by these people and I was told I was a volunteer. In the aftermath of us growing up now, it's like, okay, we're not kids in adult bodies or whatever the false pitch was. We are actual adults. And you know what? We're looking back through the facts and it's not making sense. The more you study the law, the more you understand it's like, oh, this is full-blown child trafficking, like almost point by point. It checks out. You know, it gets done in hotels. Your time is sold to people that can come and pay for your time. In what world is that a religious experience? And why are our parents co-signing on all of it? This is not the Boy Scouts where everybody thought they were going to be doing some knots. And then it turned out that it was infiltrated by horrible people. They knew what sessions were. They knew what ethics sessions were. They knew what these courses were about. And nothing ever rose a red flag for anybody in involving the kids at that same level of intensity that this man pitched to do everything at, which is L. Ron Hubbard.
Yeah, it's incredibly damaging, especially to the children, which is why we wanted to have you on to speak from that perspective. So your parents left. They were deemed as suppressive people, or an SP in Scientology terms, which means everyone is supposed to disconnect from anyone who is an SP. So completely cut off from family and friends and community, which is another reason why it's hard for people to leave, because they don't want to be cut off from their family. So when your parents left, we know from what you just said that you do get back into Scientology. So what was it, or what was the time frame of not having Scientology? Was your life completely different? And then why did your family get back into it?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, my childhood became a little bit more normal, because now they fled to the north of Mexico, which is where they were from. My grandparents were living in the north of Mexico at this time. So then I started going to normal schools and my parents took normal jobs, and we weren't living in any kind of wealth, but, you know, we always had a roof under our head, you know, like, and I mean, Scientology still always played a part, because when they're teaching you the language never left them. The language is what made them feel they were powerful or had a one-up on people out of there, because they spoke in these secret euphemisms that, unfortunately, they're sadistically disguise what you're doing, you know? So as children, we were like still told, do an ethic cycle. You know, like, I could be playing with Barbie dolls and then all of a sudden I'll be locked up for 3 days inside a room being told that I'm in a treason condition, and with an ethics book I had to write down, find out that you are, and find the answer to that. I could barely read and write, but I cannot come out of that room until I write the right answer to that question. It's all these sadistic punishments that you're doing on kids that are like, in what world are you? Going back to like, well, but they're just like an adult. No, it's intellectual abuse is what it's called. You know, we didn't know what in the hell they were talking about.
Yeah. Can you elaborate on why you would have been in trouble playing with Barbie dolls?
Well, like in the case of all the LGBTQ kids that grew up in Scientology, and there's so many of us, we were treated in horrible ways because we were told that we were out of valence. The whole idea was that our thetan and the body have to align. And since we're not a body, we're a thetan. If the thetan doesn't align with the body, then the thetan has something disgusting with the thetan. So it was always us that we were very disgusting, because we were manifesting this other thing that is not the body. So it was all, it's this disassociation between who we were as kids. Like, we don't even know what in the hell they're talking about. Again, it's like throwing these concepts with no boundaries, just like, hear us and giving you these whole lectures that we just have to disassociate. They're just blabbing their mouth about stuff that makes no sense.
Yeah, it's just blatant homophobia. And I want to get your opinion on this. Would you say it's similar to let's just say, a fundamentalist Christian theology saying that someone is possessed or has demons because they're gay and they just need to exorcise those demons. It kind of sounded similar as far as like your thetan and your body are not aligning and it's your fault and you have to do something to fix it.
Well, in this case, we were not being told demons, right? Because what Scientology does is Scientology looks down on other religions. And the pitch that they gave us was like, we have technology. All the other people have nothing but a book. It was literally like we were never like, oh, look at those people. They don't have technology. We have technology. We have this machine. No one else has it. We do have it figured out here. Everyone else is, you know, like... So it never felt like that, because the idea of demons, we were told, oh, demons are, that's just a lie. It's so stupid. You know, never mind that they were pitching Xenu at a level that no child usually would get
that's
to.
That's what it's I'm like... saying. That's what I'm saying. It seems comparable, even though they're different and they're phrased as different. It seems like it's the same type of thing where they're saying that something is attached to you and it's your fault and you have to fix it, instead of just some people are born gay and some people are not born gay.
Yeah.
Does that make sense?
100%. Literally.
Okay, so you felt ostracized and punished for your tendencies as a child, not really understanding to what capacity you were doing something wrong. Is that fair?
I mean, it was living in total hell, Shalice, because it's like you just think that there's something so disgustingly wrong with you 24/7, right? And imagine, I went all the way up the levels in Scientology. I was trying to fix myself. I was like, there's got to be something really wrong with me. And, you know, again, it's like you're adulticizing kids, right? We had no innocence. We were adults. By the time I was 12, I was an adult. I was convinced. I was talking like adults. You could put me in any place in that hotel and I'd be having a conversation back and forth in this language that makes no sense. And also speaking at that level where, you know, a lot of kids didn't even understand what in the hell the language was, right? Some of us were so adulticized that we did. It was almost like a double-edged sword, because it then exposed me to be an auditor at age 12. And then I thought I was being very smart, learning about how it worked and da-da-da-da-da. But meanwhile, I was just putting myself further into the lion's den, because now I was an adult. I was an interrogator. I was putting myself in all these untenable positions that no child should ever in the world be placed in.
Right. Yeah, absolutely. So your parents leave Scientology. The Scientology doesn't really leave them. So in some ways, your life is different, maybe a little bit more pleasant. But at the same time, you are still going through these punishments of Scientology. So your parents join again. Were you just like, no, not this? Or did you know what that meant moving forward? What was your reaction as a kid when that happened?
It was very confusing, right? Because as a child, it's very hard for your intuition, even though you feel like it's always weird. I was embarrassed to tell my friends that when I was in now regular schools in Mexico, like when they asked your religion, everybody there was Catholic. And I was like, oh yeah, I'm Catholic. I would never want to say, you know, but I would not have a first communion. And they're like, oh, where was it? And I'd just be always like, oh, you know, you're always in this like, you just so embarrassed because you say you're this other thing. And for kids especially, it's like, you're what?
Yeah.
That's so weird. And I thought it was weird, but I thought it was like, you know, because they don't get it, right? It was like this whole thing is like, no, and I don't know how to explain it because it didn't even make sense to me. So, I mean, my parents do get roped in and they always acted like it was such a great thing, right? Like everyone's on a hype. Oh my God, we're back in. We're doing great. Everything's amazing. But it's always this like, again, cognitive state of this dissonance because, you know, now they're getting less money. They're getting sold all these courses that they don't need. They're getting further roped in. It does come with its side benefits of the community, like you said, right? Because they could get maybe jobs with other people that weren't there. So there's always some sort of benefit that the adults are getting by being part of this community, you know. And but again, the problem is that once they ensnare the children into the hotels, it's just indefensible, period.
Yeah, I wonder what's going through your mom's head specifically, because I know you'd mentioned off camera before this that your dad moved to Florida and your mom was basically a single mother trying to make money and raise the kids. And she agreed to go back into Scientology. I imagine part of that was so she could reconnect with her family. But also the reason that she wanted to leave in the first place is because you nearly died and you were not being taken care of. So I wonder what was going through her mind. Do you have any idea as to how she sort of justified going back in and placing you back into the care of Scientology?
I mean, if I had to guess, because that's all I can do, sort of guess into what type of mindset, it's like they are getting seduced to be part of something important that matters. So they were always very needing that. We need to be part of something that actually matters.
And having that's, a purpose.
And what I'm saying it matters is because, like, they're getting access to Tom Cruise, John Travolta, all the celebrities that, even if they're not there, they're like, oh, but we're part of their hotel. We've been selected, you know? So, and then further on, my sister did end up, you know, getting connected with celebrities. So there's always something you're getting in that network of people that are all belonging to this hotel. No other religion goes and vets people to see if you qualify to be part of their. And that's the thing that is so different about Scientology. It's like, as much as they go, oh yeah, we need to get it everywhere. Well, you know what? You don't qualify unless you qualify.
Would that be something like you don't qualify because you don't make enough money, or what would disqualify somebody?
Does your aunt work at the FBI? Disqualified. Does your uncle work at the NSA? Disqualified. Even like if your grandparents worked at the CIA 3 generations ago, disqualified. If you have any connection to any reporters, we need to know. Who are they? Where are they? Are they against Scientology, not Scientology? So like when you really start understanding, like, why are the qualifications that?
Because they're trying to hide stuff.
It doesn't make sense. And then for the IRS to sit there and purport that it doesn't know anything about anything and they just think that everyone's having a religious experience, it's like, stop. Like, really, like at this point, we are adults. What's going on in there is government sanctioned, and it's a problem because the FBI just got sued for not doing their job for protecting children. None of us can do anything, right? Like, you and I can sit here and cry about the children being abused. We have no right to do anything. Nothing. We don't can investigate them. We cannot bring them to court. We cannot do anything. We can only just hope that there's a better future in the future. But, you know, we are living in a time where the FBI is being sued by the Epstein victims for bungling the investigation. And then that's what continues the abuse to happen to more kids. And we're saying the same thing. It's like, in what world is everything that happened to us? And you said, like you said, so many second generations, Liz Ferris, Liz Gale, Aaron, Nora, Laura, Jenna Miscavige, Miriam Francis, Mike Brown, like everything that happened to us is still being done to kids as we speak, with no one, everyone pretending that everyone's an adult inside these places. It's like they have 0 plausible deniability, Shalice, because they all follow the same policy. And it's like, today, as Americans, we should be asking them, that's a false pitch. That's not called religious pitch. Oh, you're about to have a child. In no world will you ever go and with a straight face say, my religious belief is my child is an adult. That's called being delusional and cognitive dissonance. And it's not supported protective speech. Seriously, that's the law applies more there when you're acting like that unhinged, you know, like. Because that's what children are owed. They're owed advocates. You know, we needed someone to say, oh my God, the children are the ones at risk when we were stuck in there. Because it's very hard to make the case for an adult. And it's very hard for us to sit here and tell an adult what they should be into and not into.
Mm-hmm. It's extremely dangerous. And I want to hear more about your story specifically. When did you come to the United States and what center were you placed in?
So I came to the United States through the Juarez-El Paso border, and I was placed into the Flag Land Base. So it's like their Mecca of Mecca. You know, it's supposed to be the place where the technical perfection, and that's what we were always being told as children. You have to be technically perfect. So we had to learn all this rhetoric from L. Ron Hubbard and cite it like attorneys. Literally, we needed to know on December 3rd, 1973, this policy says this and this, and everything had to be referencing to a policy of L. Ron Hubbard. So I'm taken out of school. I didn't finish past seventh grade as I'm coming into another country now. No one in Clearwater cared that I didn't finish high school. And then I was just doing courses inside the hotel that my parents paid for, $45,000+ for me to become a class 4 auditor. And
wow,
the parents put us in that place. They knew what an auditor was. My dad was an auditor. My mom was an auditor. All my aunts and uncles were auditors. All the people know what it is that they do. It's just that they're under this delusion that, again, kids and adults are the same thing. And it's just sickening. It's sickening and indefensible. And it's something that really needs to be questioned loudly right now, because the fact is that all these kids are exposed to everything we got exposed to. And it's unthinkable.
Yeah. So at 12 years old, you become an auditor. For those who aren't familiar, can you describe maybe one of your standout sessions, what that entails, what that involves, kind of the intensity of it? Because I have a general idea, but for those who aren't familiar.
I mean, the intensity, I don't think I could even possibly describe it. It's intense AF. First of all, the whole thing, the whole pitch, this is how I was used to be a supervisor and grooming all these role plays that are going on with dolls at first, because everything happens in this big courtroom first, where all manner of adults and kids are all together. So you're always seeing children your own age doing this, and you're like, and there's an adult there, and okay, so my parents said it was okay. Jenna's parents said it was okay. Lara's parents said it's okay. Aaron's mom was literally one of my students and somebody that I knew at that time. Like, so that environment filled with adults and dolls and very sort of naive artifacts, like clay demo, like everything looks very like childlike, actually, when you really think about it. Like these little pieces with little cars and little... It's literally toys. That's a demo kit. It's like a bunch of little toys that you're supposed to be checking the L. Ron Hubbard materials. So with that environment of everything being so mixed, that's how they all become like, oh, this is all so normal. And then from there, you go into a hotel room that's converted with a massage table, with a big couch, with two cameras on top of you, with something in your ear so that the case supervisor, so-called case supervisor, the people that are sitting in one other hotel converted room over there, watching and listening to everything that you're asking the person through the audit, is also then feeding you questions that you should be asking the person, and they're checking how you're reading the machine, and if you said something wrong or whatever, they're correcting you on the spot. So you're under such excruciating level of... You cannot make a single mistake. You're, even if you stumble as you ask a question, that's a mistake. You need to be technically perfect at all times. You're so pressed to just be like so pleasant. You cannot break your character. If the person becomes unhinged with you, screams at you, yells at you, you have to remain, I completely understand. We're going to get through this. You have to be there for the adult in every way, shape, or form that this role play is forcing you to be, because, you know, what I say it's a role play, Shalice, is because somebody's called auditor, somebody's called PC. I was Serge, but then I was called PC, and then I was in this thing with another random. My parents knew her, some of my first auditors, but they were in fact randoms that completed a 2-week course in a hotel and then had full access over me. Ask him anything, lock him up, keep him in that audit, as long as it calls for in the audit, they would have us for 4 or 5 hours. And you have to say you loved it at the end, otherwise they wouldn't let you go. So in what world was any of that okay, being done with the full consent of parents? And that's what makes it so confusing for us. You fully knew, you fully consented, you knew what it was for you as an adult to get it, but you never thought, maybe not them yet. Maybe at 18, if you can join the army, you can join this thing. And maybe someone can say, no one can come and tell you no. But you know what? It's like for us, it's when we were at 5, 6 years old, where we were locked up in those rooms. It's like the abuse that happened to us as complete that's the abuse that still sears in our head because you can't quell it. We go to therapy. We do as much as we could. It's that hopelessness of knowing no one was ever going to come and help us. We had to just take it and unhinged and crazy, and it didn't make any sense. But you had to somehow acclimate and dissociate because those were the only two things we could do.
Yeah, I imagine the dissociation would have been incredible because at some point you just have to shut off. You can't continue to take in all of this energy, this information, the yelling, the emotions, and you can't just be normal in that situation. Your body would have to shut off in some capacity. So auditing sessions, as far as I'm aware, usually happen when you break a rule or they think you broke a rule and they force you to confess to something that maybe you didn't even do. Why would they do an auditing session on a child? Like, what are some of the reasons that they would lock you in a room as a 5-year-old to get you to confess to something? Or do you have any examples of that?
Yeah, well, and it's a little bit more nefarious than that, because the thing about the audits was we were being told that was the safe space. Oh, if you're going in session, then okay, because that's where you go get handled, is literally what they call it. You need to go get audited so you can get handled. So what you said about, like, oh, you're malfunctioning, right? Like, and malfunctioning for a child could be like you're complaining, you're crying a lot, you're manifesting bad indicators, they call it, like literally BIs. And this is why there's all these, you know, BS terms that they devise to describe, oh, your BIs, to say your bad indicators. And it's always to, yeah, you're being judged on your behavior by these people that complete a 2-week course in a hotel, and all of a sudden they are doctors, lawyers, they're know-it-alls. Like, that's what's so dangerous about it, right? Because it's like, oh, L. Ron Hubbard did say here, and he did all the research, so we didn't have to do the research. So then we just read his BS, and then all of a sudden, all the red flags just go by them because they're on this whole, like, delusion that, you know, they really are intellectual, because this is all done very, like, okay, methodical, and not like we're joking. Like, they're very serious about it, almost too much. And that's what's so, you know, hard as a child to shake off from.
Yeah. And what's crazy is they say that the psychological industry or people, psychologists, are evil, or it's wrong, or L. Ron Hubbard had a thing against therapy, yet he employs, it's like, it seems like the main part of Scientology are these sessions which mimic therapy, broken therapy, because they think that you need to be fixed in some way, and that's the only way that you can be clear or regulated. Or it's interesting that would be one of the main parts of getting fixed, in their words, when he was very much against mental health.
Well, and the thing about the mental health that I've realized too, Shalice, is he didn't want anyone anywhere near a mandated reporter. When you're being abused to the level of how we were being abused, had I walked into the office of a mandated reporter and told them what in the hell was going on inside of that hotel, they would have had a lot of trouble. And they can rein that back. Mandated reporters are not someone that they can kneecap as easy as our own parents. Imagine, you know, could they completely destroyed any line of defense there. They implicating them on the crimes. So now, you know, it's like any child trafficker, like, well, they were pimping out their kid. Now they're implicated. Now, oh, you know, their whole pitch is like, we were doing a religious thing. Well, you know what? Check again if you were. Check again what that book said to do, because even going back to, like, in what world is false imprisoning somebody therapeutic? Even religions, like the cardinal cannot lock you up against your will. You cannot leave, sir. I mean, everyone's free to open the door and leave, right? Like, they don't have a book that says under no circumstance can that person leave on their own determinism. You cannot be pitching all these lies, because at one point it's like, how is this therapeutic if you're locking someone against their will? Maybe for an adult, it could be if they consent to it. But a child never had the ability to go, wait, what? The audit is what? I'm not going to be allowed to leave. We never liked it. I wanted to leave. You couldn't put the cans down. The more you resist it, the more they double down and triple down. I mean, this is what the rhetoric said. Everyone can be like, y'all. That's what your rhetoric said. Maybe it wasn't your idea, but you were following it. So check on that consequence now. You know, it's not personal. You were being used as a puppet. You become a puppet once you're just reading this stuff and just doing it and everyone's recording it. I mean, this is not something that was done without consciousness, and that's what's so egregious and disgusting. It's all premeditated. You're getting the feedback. You're getting the loop. You're getting all the information. Everyone has access to everything. You know too much. And then you do nothing, and nothing is at the police station being reported as child abuse. So these people can just go to a hotel, pay for it, and then, oh, everyone had a religious experience. I'm sorry, but that's not going to fly. Not in 2024 when we're halfway through our lives and now had a front row seat at all this dysfunction. And you know what? No.
And they're also turning the victims into the perpetrators. So you had to deal with these auditing sessions as a child, which your parents were paying for. You had mentioned before $500 an hour up to $1,000 an hour. They're paying for you to go in and experience this trauma thinking it's going to help you. And then at some point, the roles are reversed and you are forced to become the one who's doing the yelling or the auditing or locking people in rooms. So how did that have an effect on you? Did you step into this power? Did it feel good to have some sort of control and to be the person on the other side? What was it like when you were 12 being forced to be an auditor?
Well, the only way I can explain it is, and with a big caveat, is that we were children dominatrix. But the problem is that dominatrix, the whole thing is supposed to be, there's going to be a safe word and there's going to be boundaries,
right?
And discuss. In these
consent, yeah.
In this role plays, there was none. This was, the auditor is the ultimate in control. The other person submits to whatever this auditor is doing, and everything's being watched. Everything's being transcribed. At least that's what I would say. Like, there is no plausible deniability. There's no walking back from anybody saying, oh, we didn't know. Oh, we thought it was this and it was that. No, the facts are what's almost unthinkable because, damn, like you said, it's like, in what world was I writing down? When I was 16, I was put into the RPF, the so-called hole, with self-admitted PEDOs. And I was made to be the twin of a self-admitted PEDO. Like, my rehabilitation was contingent on him not being a PEDO, like with this false purpose rundown. So I had to get rid of his evil purposes. These people are allowed to say that they were confused and this is why they became. It's like, what is this? What in the hell was I doing in my formative years? Because that's what I give an F about. Like, I left Scientology at 35. Between leaving the Sea Org in my early 20s to 35, a lot of other bad shit happened, but I'm over it. I'm an adult. I figured it out. It's not good, but you know what? I figured it out. But what was happening in my formative years? Why did this get all allowed to happen? And moreover, how is this still going on with kids right now? That's why we're raising the alarm, because it needs to be raised. And it's almost like if people are not enraged or literally completely out of their mind, then they should be asking themselves why. Why are you okay with all of this still happening right now? You know, because going back to the protesting, they're not there protesting. The Scientology parents are not out there protesting what is done to kids. What they all should be protesting right about now. You know what? Because it's really that simple. Like, you know, you want to make amends, start protesting what was done to kids. Go on the record, tell people what it was. And repent for it. Repent. Like, literally, like, everyone's going to have to repent.
Yeah. So you mentioned this about the pedophile and how you were in charge of somehow rehabilitating him. And if you're comfortable, are you okay with talking about the ways in which they tried to get you to, I don't know, fix him, or the Scientology, quote, technology behind all of that?
So they were calling it the false purpose rundown. So the false purpose rundown was supposed to address evil intentions. So obviously, and this is kind of like how Scientology pretends to be very like, oh, we're so ethical, because they're going like, oh, look, he's being a pedophile. He's evil intentions. We're labeling him evil. But we also have a technology that will fix it. And the technology was, They had a form called the second dynamic form. And in the form, it's like, for example, it asks, have you ever done something sexually perverted with children? It's a full-blown self-incrimination question, right? If you answer, yes, I have, you're talking about a felony. Self-admitted right there. This is not like, oh, tell me what's in your conscience, and then it can go into a lot of places. So this is data mining specifically for the admission. So then he would tell me, oh, yes, because he had done that. You know, when I was the ethics officer at the hotel, I did XYZ with this underage girl. So my job then was supposed to find out, okay, tell me A through C. Don't tell me XYZ. I need to know A to C what happened. Like, and God forbid I miss the D in the A to C. Missing a detail of the crime that we were being told to pull, that's what they call it, pull a withhold, was like the worst thing you could do for a person that you were supposed to be there counseling. And what? So just kind of keep track of all the false pitches that are coming through. But after he admits from A to C what he did, okay, then we were supposed to find out, was there an evil purpose or destructive intention that prompted you to commit that overt? They're calling it an overt, the admission of a felony. It's called an overt. Then the person has a chance to be like, yeah, there was an evil purpose to SA every child. That was my evil purpose. So now they're admitting that they had the evil purpose to SA every child. So now it's like, was there a confusion that occurred just before you had the purpose to SA every child? And the person goes, oh, yeah, I was very confused because I was sexually attracted, but I didn't know where it was coming from. And I think I knew him from another lifetime. Okay. When was the first moment of that confusion? And now, oh, well, I think that, you know, the first moment is when I first felt the attraction. Oh my God, your needle is floating. Oh my God, I'm great. I'm amazing. Oh my God, I just you don't have anything. The technology worked on you. You now told us, admitted that you did that, all to lead to, I was confused. And then the technology worked.
What, Serge? My mind is blown right now. That is incredibly dangerous. And you are a child doing this to this person. And there's just so many things wrong with this.
5 hours a day, for five hours, Shaliza. They were calling it redemption time. So our sessions were 5 hours long every single day, Monday to Monday.
What? And you're taking in all of this traumatic information, all of these confessions as a teenager, and you're having to hold that and you're having to not react? Or like, what? How did they expect you to go about these sessions?
You cannot react.
Oh.
Again, it's like you're in this false induced state of supremacy, right? Where I'm an auditor, I'm a dom, I'm in control. I am so special because I have a technology. That's where the danger of it comes. Because, you know, you as a child get co-opted, falsely co-opted into it and made to feel like you consent to it because, you know, this is being pitched as some sort of religious experience that people can do. And never mind that everything that I just explained to you is how these sessions are run. And again, it's like the devil's in the details. And the problem with Alwan Hubbard is he makes all the details so confusing so people can't quite tell what in the hell it is. But as I explained it to you, that's how all self-admitted felons that have a problem with that have been, they've all been allowed to say that they were confused. Imagine you admit to committing a crime and then you just say you were confused and then you just paid $1,000 an hour and then your needle floated and then everything is great.
So what happens then once they're considered better or fixed? Do they just put them right back into the system? Does anyone watch them around kids? Like, any precautions taken, or they're just fine now?
The whole system is always surveilling, right? So it's always being surveilled. It's just what is done with the surveillance that doesn't make sense. Because Scientology would be like, oh, we're so ethical. As soon as we find something like that, we're dealing with it. But you're never dealing with the law. You're always circumventing from the law. You see? And the problem is, in our case, at least, like, and I think that the Mormons, you guys had a little more plausible deniability as to how these things were dealt with once something like that could be maybe made known. Here, it was like, go audit them. Go ask them the question. Have them fully admitting. Get the child also interrogated. So you get it from both sides so that if the child's not saying something they did, you get it from the adult. And now you can also get it from the child. Because this auditor gets told, oh, you know, they also did a BJ. And the adult only talked about the BJ, but the child hasn't talked about it. So did you do anything else? Leading questions, asking them horrific questions. All done with a straight, this is audit. This is L. Ron Hubbard. This is the technology. This is IRS approved. They cannot leave. They don't have a legal representative. They don't have a way to field the questions. They can get as disgusting as they want, as explicit as they want. And, you know, this is what we're sounding the alarm on. This is all disgusting, nauseating, indefensible rhetoric that does not belong in any child being exposed to it in any way, shape, or form. It's got to come with a warning label, literally.
Well, isn't there an additional layer to that? So if they bring in the child and they try to get information out of the child of something that the adult did to them or made them do, it's not to support the child. It's to find out why the child drew it into them in big, huge air quotes, like the child pulled it in. So they're blaming the child. They're not helping the child.
Pulled it in is what they called it. It's always your fault, right? And the whole idea is like, look, we told you all that the 2D rules, meaning the second dynamic, the euphemism for anything that happens in the sexual realm, we're very strict here. Nothing is supposed to happen. So yeah, exactly. Like, in what world are you having a hotel filled with adults and teenagers? And you just tell everyone at the hotel, nothing is supposed to happen. But if it happens, we have the technology to handle it. Do you see what I'm saying? And then it's like, well, what's that technology? Full incrimination, full admission, full video recording it, full transcribing it, and never ending up at the police. They have the police on speed dial. These protests have shown us that they do know how the police is. They're not so insulated that they have no idea who they are. In what world have any of those felonies never been reported to the police? I call it, they're laundering felonies. They're monetizing. Like, for example, the adult that you just mentioned in a hypothetical example, he's paying $500, $1,000 an hour. These are like high attorney rates that you would have to be paid to be defended on admitting to a felony. So in what world is me, a child in a hotel that completed a two-week course, end up in a scenario where I'm asking someone about a self-incriminated question that asked directly for a felony, yes or no? And then all of a sudden they paid money and I'm supposed to never speak about it because I'm bonded by the auditor's code that L. Ron Hubbard wrote on a piece of paper. It just makes no sense.
I'm trying to wrap my head around how you dealt with any of this as a teenager, as a child, being so isolated. Can you talk a little bit about the hotels in depth as far as what were the living arrangements like? Were you sharing rooms? Did they feed you? Kind of like the basics of your living situation.
I mean, I think in a nutshell, you could just call it communal AF. Everything is communistic to the nth, right? Like everything is shared, everything together. We're all the same. We're all here to save the world. So we were in these disgusting apartments called the Hacienda Gardens, like mildew in the carpets, brown, disgusting. They were trying to renovate them here, right? Little by little. But mind you, the executives lived in luxury. The executives had down comforters. The executives had children that were servicing them, cleaning their apartments. The executives had, you know, the latest Acura. They really were into Acuras. You know, every year they would be gifted a new Acura for the captain, Debbie Cook. So she was always driving around in a fancy new car. And it was like, you know, it's just the slaves and the slave masters, you know. And for us, we were so confused because we were owned, you know. And I just feel like I didn't understand how to understand my situation. I didn't understand what was going on.
Yeah, because you also don't really have a baseline of what is supposed to be considered a normal childhood. You don't really know what a quote normal family unit would look like because you're separated from your parents and you are put in these adult situations and forced to grow up a lot faster and be in rooms where you're taking on horrific information and you're just supposed to digest it and pretend like you're not affected by it while being forced to live in these horrible situations. So I know that they had you, or they convinced you, to sign a billion-year contract yourself to join the Sea Org. So let's talk a little bit about what that looked like, and then eventually what made you realize you needed to get out of there.
So the recruitment started immediately. The minute I landed to the children's course room, because they had like a children's course room at the Fort Harrison Hotel, and it was called Division 6, and that was called the Introductory Courses. And immediately there, I started getting taken by this Sea Org recruiter that started to molest me. They would take us to this little room. And, you know, again, like for me, it was like my father and me had such a toxic relationship. He was so homophobic. So I was completely set up to this other man comes in and gives me all this attention and takes me to a place. Then they also have all this language to confuse you. They're like, we have a lot of ARC. That means they have a lot of love for you. Oh, we know each other from another lifetime. I feel like there's a connection between us in another lifetime, maybe. That's what I'm feeling now. So all of these words were used to seduce us as kids and to feel like, and then they're also Sea Org members, so they're supposed to be the most elite of the best, you know? So I developed a very inappropriate relationship with this man, you know, and it started like right there. And then I ended up signing a billion-year contract with Debbie Cook and Janet Herring. But since I was 12, they put me on what they call a project prepare. So sometimes if you were too young or whatever, they're like, okay, well, we'll get you started, but let's prepare you for it. So then that's when I ended up training to become a class 4 auditor and then doing all this audits. So then at 15, I was delivered already a class 4 and a clear. So I had been already paraded by all of the hotel. Oh my God, look at this child. He's only 15 and look what all that he's done. And, you know, all of us that were very young and moving up the bridge, what they called, we were considered prodigies. And then we were being used to lure more minors. Oh, look, they did it. This is an example of how you should be really being like. And all, even that is absolutely disgusting because, you know, again, these course rooms felt normal because there were kids around. I was never in a place where it was all adults and just me as a child.
Yeah. So I want to make sure I understand correctly, and we don't have to go too deep into this if you don't want to. It seems like they used your sexual orientation to manipulate you into signing a contract. Is that what you were meaning to say?
No, I don't think so, because it was more like I became a high asset for them, right? I said, class 4, I can do these interrogations. And Shalice, the courses are horrific. People struggle to get through them because it's like, you know, imagine what you have to dehumanize yourself, what you have to get comfortable with. And that's sort of like the sacrifice and the plight that kind of comes along with it. All the things that you're reading is psychobabble. Like, it's so hard to understand. It's so dense. It's not there. So I was already like a very good recruit target because I was class 4 and clear. So I already had value. Like, my parents had already invested in me. Like, let's say I was already $100,000 worth in just the services of Scientology. So then my parents were giving me to Scientology, and that also allowed them to not have to pay for me anymore as a minor. It's like the financial benefactor trafficking transaction that happens between the Scientology parents and the people at the hotel. Oh, here's my child. Now you pay for him. Now I don't have to take care of him. And again, the fact that we were 15 when this transaction happened is problematic.
Yeah, that makes sense. So were there any other moments that you wanted to talk about in your childhood or teen years that really shaped or informed why you decided to eventually leave?
I mean, I would say that I had no idea what we were facing as kids then, but I was forced to leave and cut out all my associations with these people when I had reached a level of financial security and agency that they couldn't screw with anymore. And one that allowed me to start to process, which is a luxury that trauma survivors don't usually ever get, right? Because you don't ever have the time to stop and process. You're always having to cope, pay your rent, this and that. So only until that happened, I was able to start connecting dots that I, you know, would have never had the strength to connect before. And yeah. Then connecting with actual therapists, connecting with actual support, connecting with actual professionals, with actual lawyers, with actual people that have my back now, in a way that's taken me 9 years to claw my way out of being left in a state of roadkill. By the time I did leave, I was what I would call spiritual roadkill. Like, I didn't want to be here anymore. Like, my coping mechanism is like, how do I, you know, say goodbye? And luckily, with a lot of people that cared for me along the way, I ended up always at the right place to deal with all the bad, toxic coping mechanisms that came out of being in this horrible place. And now we're advocating so that no more children go through what we went through. You don't have to get to a midlife crisis, go to the state of utter despair, because you should have never been exposed in the first place. That's common sense. What we're saying is common sense. As much as it's being twisted and turned into, oh, you're saying this, is you're saying that. No, it's called common sense. Kids are kids. Don't say anything else past that, because it's a false pitch, whatever else you try to say about that reality. And that's where we need to begin with these hotels.
Yeah. When were you able to get yourself out of those hotels? So we have a gap here. We have, you were 15 when you signed the billionaire contract. You were 35 when you left. So how were you able to physically remove yourself from that environment, start making enough money to start being able to have those realizations?
What happened was that in my early 20s is when I left the billionaire contract. And I had a wife at the time. So I left together with my wife at the time. And we owe them like almost $100,000 combined. But we moved to New York. That's the first place that I ended up. I'm that cult person that left a cult and landed in New York. Like, that, there's a show about it. What is it called? I forget the name of it. But it's like, it's a whole parody of this woman leaving a cult and landing in New York.
I don't know.
You don't know which one?
Oh, is it the Kim?
Yes.
The Kim one?
Yes.
What is it?
Yes.
Unstoppable Kimmy,
yes.
Schmidt? That one?
Yes.
Is that how you felt?
Well, you know, I felt more like I was Sarah Jessica Parker from Sex and the City, because that's what inspired me to want to move to New York. I watched Sex and the City while I was in the Sea Org, which I was not really allowed to do because I snuck in a TV, portable TV, into my room, which was completely not allowed. And we watched Sex and the City and we were just like, we want to get out of this billion-year contract. By the time we were in our early 20s, like, they put me to wash bathrooms with muriatic acid for about 6 months and were interrogating me every day to try to break me into staying and saying, okay, never mind. But, you know, when you start getting older, you also like don't care. I was like, okay, I knew what I was signing up for, to leave, but I also couldn't afford to not get declared, because if we left just without permission, then we would lose all touch with our parents, and our parents never joined the Sea Org. So we wanted to sort of go back to that, but they wouldn't let us stay in Florida because they're like, oh, a lot of people know you. We wouldn't want you to be around here. So we ended up living to New York, having no place where we were going to, no clue where we're going to live, work, nothing. Just like landing in New York and figuring it out. If you can make it there, you can make it anywhere.
Yeah. I mean, what a place to not have anything set up. It's one of the hardest places to live in. Was that a huge shock for you?
You know what? Again, it's like everything worked out. I mean, it was the naivete, I think. We just landed there. I didn't know anything else other than Clearwater, Florida, and that hotel. I had a little bit of childhood in Mexico, but I was just like, I mean, I'm sure there's a lot of jobs and a lot of apartments. And somehow with that attitude, I ended up getting a job and an apartment, and I was making way more than I had ever made in my whole entire life for doing not even like a tenth of what was expected in that other thing. So at first it was all just like joy. You know, I was like in the city, the city was great. Everything was just like, everything was great. Everything was great. Everything after that was great. I was working at Grand Central Station at Kenneth Cole. I got a job there. So I was like, you know, taking the train to Grand Central Station every day and selling. And I loved selling clothing. I always had loved clothes. So I was selling a lot of clothes and everything was seemed so easy now, you know, like everything was, and then we were just like making money, having like days off. We never had a day off. You could go to Central Park. You could go around the city. There was so much and we didn't need that much. And then we did end up leaving after a year because there were so many more people that we knew here in Los Angeles that were part of this matrix. So, oh, I'll give you a job here. I'll hook you up with that. And that, so, well, let's go to L.A. So then I started being part of the LA scene here, you know, and it took me a while to like make the money so that I could pay the freeloader debt. But then I fucking like pay the freeloader debt and then got in debt and then I had to like work to pay all of that debt again. And, you know, but the more I grew up, the less separated with Scientology I was. So my last job with Scientology was auditing, was being hired by this woman called Charmaine Roger. That was like the woman that got all the money out of the most millionaires of Scientology. And she hired me to, for me and her son, to audit Bob Duggan, the biggest billionaire of Scientology's children. And there were like 5, 6, and 9. So I ended up getting paid a lot of money from him, and then I ended up hiring this other guy named Tyler in Florida because all the kids were in Florida and I was in LA and I didn't want to fly to Florida. So I ended up setting up Tyler to audit the kids there. And then we got fired because we put him on a process called Own Time. And that's the only process that I would probably recommend a child in Scientology ever get, because Own Time is the only process where you tell the child, okay, this is a session. This is your own time. Do whatever you want. We're going to just play. We're going to like let you be. I got fired because I wasn't having them on, you know, tougher processes going up the bridge. And then after that, I had invested some money with Bob Duggan. And then I ended up making some money. And that's when I broke the full umbilical cord with Scientology, because it was like for the first time I started to process what happened. Just like the walls were caving in on me, because it's like, first I thought if I have money, I'm going to be happy. And then as soon as I had it, I was like, it was the worst. Like everything just crumbled on me. All the delusion just crumbled, you know, and I started to have to like connect to what I had been through. And I mean, it's been crawling our way out of that, you know, and it's horrible. It's horrible. We've tried, you know, to do our best in the aftermath of it all, really.
Right. I mean, I imagine that once you got to that point and you were financially in a good position, your body finally said, okay, we can start to deconstruct this now. We're in a safe enough space to where we can actually look at it with a critical eye and understand what actually happened. So how did that affect your relationships? Did the relationship with your wife fall apart at that point? Was it going well?
No, that was actually before, like after my wife and I separated first. So I first came out, but my parents were still sort of like, oh, okay, you know, like with this idea that it's all LGBT friendly or whatever. That was sort of kind of being, I was told, being told like, no, we'll accept you. It's okay. But my parents came to my house one day and they were just like doing an intervention on me. Like, you have to come up the bridge and you have to learn these things. And, you know, I got to that point where I knew my sexuality was being attacked again. That's when I cut off my parents and I was like, get the F out of my house was the last conversation I ever had with my parents 9 years ago, you know, because I just felt like they were going back to that whole, we're going to tell you who to be. And at that point, I didn't understand a lot. All I understood was like, I'm going to be this because I need to be this. And I get it that you hate it and you're disgusted by it, but you know what? I got to live for me. Right now, I'm an adult and I have to live for me and I got to figure it out. So if this is the worst thing in the world, I'm about to find out. But that level of rebelliousness then was met with Scientology trying to grope me back in. And in an art show that I had, this influencer that was a Scientologist that was one of my my sponsors for my art show. Not sponsor, but hosting. Like, I asked her to be a host for my art show. She turned me into Scientology, then tried to get me in to get interrogated. And I was like, I was an adult. And I was just like, no, I'm not going in. I don't care. And they were threatening me. And I was like, whatever you threaten me with anymore, I don't care. You have my parents. They made their choice. I can't change them. I'm just going to start living for me. And then I went through that whole disconnection process, which it's hard because it is like committing alive. You know, you lose all these people. So it was the hardest time in my life, you know, and I made some money, but it's not like, oh my God, I had a few years to decompress because at the same time, I was like in that point of, I don't know where I'm going to, how I'm going to end up after, because that's when I felt like roadkill. Prior to that, it was always coping mechanisms, trying to survive, but then everything just fell apart and then everything was a lie. It's like, holy fuck, like, how do I even reconcile with what I'm seeing? Then I had to run to the psychiatrist. That's the first place I had to go because, you know, I'm self-harming. Like, I have to try this with so much fear. I was literally shaking before I went in there, you know? And it was like this old Jewish man that just sat there and held space and let me speak, understood from a medical perspective, all these role plays and all this. It's like, but we were always told that that's what they did. We were told the psychiatrist did that to you, that they strap you, they're going to hold you in a just straight jacket. So it was like, you know, so it's sort of like starting from there, like starting to see like how much of a lie and a fraud it really all was. Yeah. Now ending up at the hands of a doctor that's explaining to me what sadistic abuse is for the purpose of what? Like, this was just for pain. You cannot claim that you had another purpose because, again, going back to locked up against your will and all of that, those are things that psychiatrists do study because they understand psychotic behavior, right? Like humans that get dehumanized, that normalize that at scale, there's something there going on. And no wonder psychologists doesn't want anything to do with psychiatrists because they don't want to be labeled deranged. But good sir, what are you doing to kids? Make that make sense together. And then tell us again why psychiatrists are such the enemy. Because I'm not vouching for every last psychiatrist there is. I'm sure there's bad ones out there too. That's the difference. In Scientology, in what world was any of their auditors not holding people up against their will?
Yeah, I'm just extremely impressed by how you came into yourself when you got older and how you came out to your parents and you said, if you don't like it, that's it. Bye. You separated from your wife because that wasn't serving you. You sought out therapy from having the understanding as a child or being taught or programmed as a child that they are wrong and horrible and evil and are going to strap you down to a table. There's so many breakthroughs as you're talking about your story that I'm just so impressed by you and how you were able to pull yourself out of it, because it's so hard to do when you're so indoctrinated and you have been living in this one reality for so long.
No, well, thank you for saying that. I think that, you know, we're all in awe of each other because I feel like so much of the healing in this community is seeing how, you know, I call it same shit, different air freshener.
Yeah.
Because it's like at the end of the days, we were like, you know, abused by these brands, but yet the brands are not the problem. The brands don't commit the crimes. It's the people that are in there that do the bad deeds. And that's what needs to start being understood about these concepts, because everything gets hyper-generalized, like religion. Who was there? Who are the people? Who are the stakeholders? What were they doing? And then just start from there. You know what I mean? Because if kids are not safe, then in what world can you be doing anything for society? Truly, if you cannot be trusted with that, then in what world should society really take you seriously?
Yeah. And you're doing a lot of advocacy work now. You're doing protests here in Los Angeles. I want to talk a little bit about that before we go. You have your YouTube channel where you're exposing things further, having people on or going on other people's channels. So what do you want to talk about as far as the work you're doing now and how people can support you with that?
raise awareness. The plight of advocacy is to raise awareness. And the first thing that we should just raise awareness about is that no one under the age of 18 inside of these hotels should be subjected to anything that they're pitching. And if we can just achieve that, that not everyone gets carded at their door, 18 and up, I guess. I've always said 21, but they say that you can join the army. Okay. And then, but then also we need to start actually looking at the FBI for answers, because if crimes are being committed against children, that's not acceptable and it's not okay. And if that's being done under their nose, if they don't know about it, that's their lack of due diligence. That's not the, we had a very, you know, weird, no, we know what in the hell we're talking about. We've been adults since we were children. We were put in adult positions. So the FBI now needs to start answering, why were we put in adult positions? And in what world is putting children in adult positions a religious experience for that child? Because if they cannot answer that with a straight face, then they better start investigating for real and not keep bungling every last child investigation there is in this country. It's like, we would love to see the examples of where they don't bungle it, because U.S. gymnastics teams bungled, Boy Scouts bungled, Mormons bungled, Catholic people, it's all bungled. So like, it should not be bungled. Like, children investigations should have top priority, should have people that really care about the issue go and find out, get evidence. No one's saying go on a no evidence spree. All of these people that are doing these things keep evidence on themselves. So lucky for the police, there's receipts. There's receipts to everything they did to us as kids, Shalia, because they kept meticulous records. That's the one thing that Owen Hubbard did teach him, very Hitler-like. Keep records, write down the name, write down the time, write down everything that's going on. You know what I mean? So we have to raise awareness at that level. And it's the kids who don't deserve it, you know? And the more we can advocate for them, even against their own parents, you know, because we can, we are allowed to criticize a parent if they're putting their kid at risk. We are allowed to tell them, like, no, double check this. Like, this is very serious what's going on. So don't play dumb anymore. You played dumb long enough. And now it's like time to clean up all of this mess.
Yeah. And I don't know exactly when this video is going to air versus what we're talking about now, but I know that you are organizing protests this weekend. Where are those taking place? Who are you protesting to get people's attention?
Well, we're protesting now at the LA court. We're protesting at the LAPD. We're protesting at La Pubelle. We're protesting all the different Scientology centers that they have. We're protesting and expanding further to, you know, enablers. You know, we're protesting the attorneys that are just, you know, cashing checks and saying everything is great. You know, it's like there's no shortage of what needs to be protested, because child protective services needs to be protested. And that's the great thing about community. We're connecting with so many people that are running into the same problems with the same agencies, and we need to protest all of them. So they get the funding they need. They get the help they need. Whatever needs to be done, let's do it. Let's come together and do it. Actually do some of that heavy lifting so that it's harder for kids to be abused. That's all we're asking for. Let's make it harder. Let's not make it easier. Let's make it harder for that to happen. And then that's all we can expect. You know, it's not a perfect system, but we can, you know, be more fiercely involved with raising advocacy for what's not known, because that's why it happens, because it's not understood.
Yeah. So getting more eyeballs on the issue, raising the awareness, putting it in their faces, saying, hey, you need to pay attention. There's something going on here that you need to look into. And I think that's great. I love what you're doing, what you're organizing, and what you're a part of. I feel like any number of sentences that you've said already could be a Linda Listen moment. But if you have a specific Linda Listen, something else sassy that you want to say to someone who's pissed you off, or an inspirational quote for our listeners.
Kids cannot consent, and no more kids in Scientology.
Yes, I agree.
That's it.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Well, thank you so much for coming on and sharing. I know you're very passionate and I love it. There's so much energy in this interview. I'm just like, yes, I'm on board with you, Serge. You're doing a thing and it's great. And I'm happy to platform your voice and get the word out to more people. We're going to be doing more Scientology interviews as well with some of the people you even mentioned in a little bit earlier. So I'm happy to support in any way that I can. And is there any other, I mean, I know we have the Aftermath Foundation. Foundation for those who are in Scientology and need a helping hand in getting out. We'll put that in the description below. Is there any other resource that you want to shout out or ways that people can get in touch who need help?
Yeah, I mean, number one, you can all help supporting everyone that is out there on the streets, on the front lines, you know, all the people that are in our live chats, joining us, witnessing, seeing what's going on, you know, that's such huge support. Your time is everything, and your support means everything. So just continue supporting all the live streamers and everyone in these communities that are seeing us. Appreciate being seen. I think that survivors just need empowerment, and the empowerment is to be seen. So we're already so thankful for everything we have so far.
Yeah, I agree. One of our commenters posts this on every video, Cats, Cats News, break the silence, break the cycle. And I think it's very powerful because nothing can change if people don't know about it, if people don't realize these things are going on. So exposure is key, and we just have to speak out about it. So thank you again. And if people want to contact you, well, first of all, they can go to your YouTube and see what you're up to at Literally Surge, and then all of your social media handles, Literally Surge as well. We'll put those in the description. Do you have any other final thoughts before we go?
No, thank you so much.
Yeah, you're welcome. I appreciate you coming on and sharing with us. So guys, if you want to support, you have all the links now in the description. You can do so. Spreading the word, liking, sharing, commenting helps boost the algorithm. Even just watching to the end is extremely helpful for the algorithm to say, hey, someone liked this, let's boost it out to more people. And leaving those words of encouragement really mean a lot to us and our guests. If you want to support the podcast specifically, all those things mentioned are extremely helpful. You can get some merch if you'd like at cultstoconsciousness.com under the merch tab. You can become a patron if you want to do that monthly, patreon.com/cultstoconsciousness. You can come to Costa Rica with us just to hang out, have a good time. It's not culty, I swear. There's 5 spots left as of the recording of this video, and that's at the end of August. It's going to be a good time. So if you want to do that, that will be in the description. And if you like this video, we'll leave 2 more down here below that you'll want to check out. And until next time, follow your highest excitement, be conscious, and be well.
Thanks for listening. If you like what you hear, it would mean a lot if you could like and subscribe on YouTube and leave a review or a comment to help with our visibility. You can also find me on social media at cults2consciousness or reach out by email at cults2consciousness@gmail.com.